Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? Nice to see you. Nice to talk to you. Welcome. Hi, how are you? Everything okay? You all right there? You strapped in? Are you being careful? Are you looking both ways? Are you hiding with your headphones on? Are you trying to pretend like you're listening to music? Hey, how's work? What's going on? I'm Mark. This is my show. It's a podcast. I talk to people. Got a couple of people on today. Pretty exciting show. Interesting show. What I'm going to do in a few minutes is I'm going to talk to my old sidekick, Josh Brenner, who played Kyle in seasons 1, 2, and 3 of Marin. He was my assistant. You may also know him as Big Head on Silicon Valley, and he's in a movie. It's a movie coming out called Welcome to Happiness with Nick Offerman and Keegan-Michael Key. I'll talk to Josh Brenner in a little bit. I'll also be talking to the playwright Stephen Karam, author of The Humans, which I saw off-Broadway but is now on Broadway, a tremendous play. This is part of a series of playwrights I seem to be having on. Maybe it's not a series. Yeah, there's more coming. Yeah. But it's been interesting for me to go to theater, and I enjoy it. It's a lively and relevant art form that we need to engage in, and The Humans is a great play. I talked to him in New York in a hotel room, so that's what I'm trying to tell you. Josh Brenner and Stephen Karam on the show today. I do want to get some business out of the way, personal business about my dates coming up. The Tripany House shows have been spectacular here in Los Angeles at the Steve Allen Theater. I want to thank everyone for coming down. There are several shows coming up. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour. I'll be at the Steve Allen Theater on May 31st, June 7th, June 14th, June 21st, and June 28th. These are Tuesdays. They're, I think, an $8 ticket. All the proceeds go to the theater. On July 7th, 8th, and 9th, I will be at the Spokane Comedy Club in Washington. Wow, I'm doing full runs, man. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 shows. And then July 14th, 15th, and 16th, I will be at Wise Guys in Salt Lake City, Utah, doing the real club work. And then July 28th, 29th, and 30th, I will be at the Comedy Attic in Bloomington, Indiana, doing the club work. And then August 18, 19, and 20, I'll be at Stand Up Live in Phoenix, Arizona, doing the club work. And then September 9th, 10th, I'll be at the Comedy Club in Rochester, New York. And for God's sakes, by the end of that run, I should definitely have a new hour, just out of necessity, so I don't lose my fucking mind. So, yeah, I mean, come to any of those shows. I hope you're enjoying Marin on IFC, which airs Wednesdays at 9 p.m. I think the fourth episode aired last night. Moving out of the rehab situation and into life. And then this is phase 2 of season 4 of Marin. It was very fun, obviously, working with Sally Kellerman, and challenging and exciting, working with Michael Lerner, who I am a fan of, despite the fact that he's a very challenging individual. And I still love him. And we pulled an episode together out of what was a pretty chaotic few days of shooting, my friends. So enjoy that. You know, like, I don't want to complain about bullshit. But I guess it's only relative to, you know, what your life is like. Obviously, people have bigger problems than this. But as I've told you before, I went through it. It almost became a narrative, but I just fucking detached from it. I got this new office space that I'm very happy with to do my work, to process things, to write and go through books and records and letters and shit that are sent to me and have meetings down there. And AT&T, they have a cell tower on top of the building that my office is in, right above my office. I didn't know this going in. I've set this up before. Now, you know, here's the deal. You know, corporations, people have their own problems with corporations. Corporations should not be treated as individuals. Corporations get away with murder, literally. I hope that what I'm talking about right now is not going to put me on an AT&T hit list. But the reality of trying to conduct business within a fucking cell tower and have a functioning stereo. See, this is where I realize it's a trite issue. But I'm an obsessive idiot. And I see injustice in mundane things. You know, God forbid I appeal to my sense of injustice to bigger, broader issues and get out there and do some campaigning or some actual selfless grassroots lobbying for the candidate of my choice. But no, I'm going to shake my fist at the great mythological god AT&T, who is a very real god, in the sense that they control a good deal of the communications for people in this world, their ability to text, send dick pics, and avoid calls from their parents, occasionally email, Wi-Fi, not benevolent, just there competing with other cell phone and phone companies, Wi-Fi as well. So not knowing that I was operating within a fucking cell tower, I was unable to use my stereo because of this horrendous buzz. Now, who knows? Just by talking about this, perhaps, look, I'll tell you this. If I have an aneurysm or some sort of psychotic break, they focused the laser and they twisted my fucking brain. And the fact of the matter is, they don't even need to do that because they've sent guys over. We've turned things off. We've pinpointed that the buzz is directly related to the fact that I'm working inside a cell tower. They turned some shit off, the buzz went away. So it is completely relative to AT&T's equipment on my roof. So every time I go to my office to do a little work done, I'm like, maybe it's gone. I turn it on. No, not gone. And yesterday, not only was it not gone, it was fucking worse than it's ever been. And I'm like, I got to get out of the office. Not because I'm a fucking baby who wants to play his records, just because I'm obsessive and I'm not going to be able to let it go. Because I think what most corporations want you to do is just admit defeat and move on, whether it's with a product, whether it's with anything. They're just playing the odds. You know, if they've got, you know, 5 pissed off people out of 100, fuck them. And that's with anything. So if 1 or 2 people get the bad pair of shoes or the shitty service or hurt themselves badly in a car accident, can we fit it into our bottom line? Take care of this shit and just move on business as usual and shut that guy up. And, you know, I wish, you know, I could get over it, but I can't because I'm obsessive and I want to enjoy my workspace and I want to work the way I want to work. I have the freedom to do that. No one's going to tell me to shut the fuck up and just, you know, forget about the music. And I've tried to tell myself that. Like, hey, is it really that important? You know what? It kind of is. It kind of is. But I assumed, it's going to be some sort of very pathetic David and Goliath story where David doesn't win. He just kind of goes like, nah, I guess I'll just take my rocks and go to some other space. You know, they just want you to just like live with it. It's just, and I think so many of us do that on so many levels. It's like, ah, this is the way it is. Fuck that. I'm either going to split or they're going to turn their shit off. Because it's fucking my head up. They don't even need to put the zap on my brain. They've already done it just by not fixing it because I'm an obsessive idiot. So it annoys me that my brain works like that. It really does. My guest right now is a guy I worked with. I did great comedy with. I have a lot of respect for. He's a funny kid. And Josh Brenner's in a new film, Welcome to Happiness, that you can see in theaters now and video on demand. You can also see him as Big Head on the HBO show Silicon Valley. So this is me and my old buddy, Josh Brown.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Tenor. No hard feelings.
Man, I mean...
No hard feelings. You know, we did what we could. We tried. We tried to get you on this last season. There's just no way.
Can I tell you something?
You were too essential to Silicon Valley. Too essential.
I mean, not only is my character not essential, I as a human am also, dude, honestly, my wife, yeah. like 2 months ago, my wife was like, what's wrong with you?
Right.
You're like bummed and you're like moping around.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know. And she's like, oh, I know what it is. It's because you're not doing Marin. I swear, she honestly said that. Because I'd had this, I think I texted you, I had this string of people coming up and being like, dude. And I'd be like, oh, you watch Silicon Valley. And they're like, what? No. Like, Marin is my favorite show on TV.
Oh.
Like, honestly, like, people, it was like the universe just, like, rubbing it in my face.
Yeah. You know, you were always very good, and I had to just keep up with you in our scenes on
brother.
Marin. And what?
Give me a break.
Solid. Always solid.
Yeah.
Ready for work.
All you were
riffing.
All you were doing was writing, directing, executive
right.
producing.
But I wanted to act.
Cameras.
Yeah, but no one sees that shit. All they see is like, I don't know, Marin's like a little stiff,
Give me a break. Well, seriously, I just told you this a minute ago, but I'm going to tell you it again.
Right.
This season, it's like, it's unbelievable. Like, that's some heavy lifting you're
Thanks,
doing,
man.
And it's fucking, it's really good.
Thank you.
It's really good.
I think I stepped up to the plate.
Yeah, and Grand Slam home run.
Thank you very much.
Sports.
And you are doing a good job yourself on the Silicon Valley. I watched one episode last night, and I just happened to be, like, full of you.
That's rare.
Yeah.
You really... I have a friend who texts me after every episode I'm not in and says, best episode yet of the season. Every single one.
Good friend.
Yeah, he's awesome.
How are your parents? The lovely people that came to see me
oh
in Texas.
Oh, my God. They love you. I swear, like, I talk to them once a week on Shabbos.
Yeah.
And it's like, how's Mark doing? I'm like, guys, I haven't seen Mark. They're like, do you know he was so nice to us? I was like, yeah, because I know, because we've talked about it a lot of times now. They love you.
They're good people.
Yeah, I mean, they're the best.
And you're still vegetarian?
Yeah. Wait, how did you know?
Is that a thing we talk? I worked with you for 3 years.
Well, I didn't know I was so in your face about it. I try to, you know...
Vegetarians, there's no subtlety to that. Even when you're not trying to be in someone's face about it. Yeah, there's a slight superiority thing that happens that you guys all disclaim.
That is true. I am 100% superior to everyone who eats meat. That's a fact. That is a fact about me, is that I'm better than people who eat meat.
Right.
Yeah. So if you're listening and you eat meat, I'm better than you.
Yeah, well, I get that, and I'm not sure I disagree. It's however you want to live your life. If you don't know the joy of a good burger, that's
no, I do
yeah.
Because I wasn't always a vegetarian, and that makes me even more special.
Sure,
is that I remember
you fought
it.
The fight.
I remember it, and I still say, you know what? I don't need that because I'm such a good person.
Oh, okay, all right. So what was it? Was it the animal screaming thing?
Oh man, I grew up kosher. I was raised in a kosher house, so you know
that's got nothing to do with being a vegetarian. That's just weird.
Well, this is
two
a fun
sets
thing.
Of utensils.
This
two
is a,
sets of cutting boards.
This is the fun thing about my house is it was a kosher house, so we had two sets of utensils. We had the dairy and we had the meat, but we also had a set of treif silverware for when we had like takeout Chinese and that kind of thing.
Oh really?
So we were, you know, it was like very very conservative, and unless, you know, somebody
that's
needed
weird.
To have some like sweet and sour chicken.
Right, but that's weird because my brother did that too. Not particularly religious, but kept kosher.
Yeah, it's a weird thing.
It's something about tradition and discipline, and I guess it's godliness at all times, even when you're being ungodly. Like, you're assuming that God's not paying attention if you use the treif silverware. They like,
right.
Well, at least they're not using the ordained or utensils.
That's correct. Yeah, we're showing a sign of respect. You know, it's
right.
Like,
and nobody's
Shabbos
perfect.
Boy.
No one's perfect. The Shabbos Goy?
The Shabbos Goy.
What is that?
You know, so like I don't have to turn on the light switch on, right, on Shabbat. But I bring in a Shabbos Goy and say, oh, it's dark in here. It's dark. Sure would be nice if the lights were on. And then that's code. Yeah. I'm not going to turn it on because, yeah, you know, I'm a good Jew. But
that's right.
The Shabbos Goy.
Yeah. And nope. Then you go like, God, did you see that? No respect.
I can't believe that guy just flipped the lights. He doesn't know any better. He's just a goy.
You were that Shabbosy?
No.
No.
But kosher, yes.
I didn't realize you were that that Jewy.
Yeah, pretty Jew. That's sweet of you to say. I mean, look at my face.
But you're Texas Jew?
Texas Jew, yeah.
Yeah.
Galveston Project, motherfuckers.
Yeah. I've met a few.
Yeah, it's a weird breed.
But here's the thing that was interesting about you that and it's surprising that I didn't ultimately resent you right out of working with me. But you're a Harvard guy.
Oh yeah.
Don't you know?
Well, you know, like people don't like that.
No, but you're different. You're different. See, you don't ride the same high ground with Harvard as you do with vegetables.
Oh,
you can't because people already assume it. You know, vegetarianism is something we can all process. You know, we kind of get it, but Harvard is very exclusive, and you underplay that one.
You're not going to shake. Yeah, you're not going to shake the terribleness of no matter. Like, I can make a joke about how being a vegetarian is a superpower, but whatever you do with Harvard, it's just going to it's terrible.
But you didn't study acting, right? There,
you can't. You can't really.
Right.
Because that wouldn't be serious.
Right.
To study acting.
What was it? English, right?
Yeah, I studied English. And then, but they, under the English program, you could take acting classes at the American Repertory Theater, which is like
down the street. Yeah.
Right across the way.
ART,
so. ART, yeah. So I took classes there and did plays there and all that stuff.
Oh, really? That's where you started at ART? Doing like student plays, or did you get into some bigger ones?
I was never in like their like real deal productions, but they would do cool stuff where like, you know, the staff from the ART, like the, and there's also a graduate MFA program there. They're teaching classes, and they also like would do a visiting director project. So I was like in plays directed by like the real deal people from ART, which was amazing.
Oh, yeah?
It was really cool.
Like who?
This guy, Marcus Stern, who's awesome. And then like Robert Woodruff taught a class.
Oh, yeah?
And one of the guys who wrote, like basically wrote Practical Aesthetics, like wrote the book on like sort of like mammoth acting.
Uh-huh.
Scott Ziegler, he taught stuff, you know, so like, you know. Like,
so you got some real experience.
Yeah,
just
cool
being
people.
Like an extracurricular kind of thing.
Yeah.
Did you get credit for those classes?
Yeah, the English department was, man, they were
loose.
Fast and loose. Yeah, it was like going to Brown in the English department. You could do whatever the fuck you wanted.
So you get, so you go to Harvard for English and then you're like, you know that acting's your thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I did like playwriting and stuff too, so I wanted to do something.
You got some plays?
That's a generous term. I did playwriting. I don't think I have plays.
Did you write a play? Sure you did. You finished one.
I wrote a play
like
for
a one act?
For a creative thesis. It's, I mean...
For a thesis?
Yeah, a creative thesis.
What
does
that mean?
Like, if you were, like, wanted to say you wrote a thesis, but you didn't want to do all the work, you did a creative thesis, and you, like, wrote a play or a screenplay or, you know, something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But that's not the same as a thesis.
I mean, I guess it was still a thesis, but, like, they call it a creative thesis so people know, like, oh, you didn't really do anything. You just, like...
All right. There was no research involved.
No, you, like, typed with one hand while you pleasured yourself. Oh. You know?
So, but it still counts as the thesis.
Yeah.
And as an undergrad, you have to do a thesis?
You don't have to. No, you can. It's an opt-in system.
Well, what does it garner you? Why do it if you don't have to? See, that's the difference between Harvard and other schools is like, you didn't have to do that, yet you did.
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually, like, I just paused to be like, what is the answer to that question? And then I was like, oh, I guess like everyone else is the answer, right?
Oh,
it's
like
people
do that.
There's just like, yeah, there's this like unbridled ambition and you just have to like be like, oh wait, I don't have that. Am I screwed up?
Right. I better do it.
Yeah, I should do something so that other people also think that I'm ambitious.
Do you feel like you got a well-rounded education? Because that's the criticism these days, that it's so hyper-competitive and so business-driven and expecting job placement and, you know, hyper-ambitious people that the broad-based nature of the liberal arts education is lost.
I drank a lot.
Okay.
Is that...
Yeah, kind of. But did you drink a lot in the spirit of being like some irresponsible hero of some kind?
No, just because it seemed fun.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like did you go out and mingle with the working class?
No.
Okay, so
no.
So everything they're saying is true.
Heavens, no. Do you know how many steps it is down from the Ivory Tower to talk to the...
To Central Square? It's one T-stop.
I didn't go near the Hong Kong, goddammit. Middle East.
The Middle East, yeah. The Hong Kong is literally in Harvard Square. You can tell
and
me...
And I still didn't go.
You didn't go have a scorpion bowl at the Hong Kong?
Oh, I went downstairs. Oh. I didn't go upstairs where there was interesting things happening.
Right.
Yeah, I stayed downstairs with the scorpion bowls.
Was that what it's called? The Comedy Studio? That was off limits?
I don't remember what... I literally never went. And then... Huh. And then I moved out here, and like all these Emerson guys were like, "Oh, you must like spend all your time at the." And I was like, "No, that was happening. That seems really cool."
So you moved out here right after undergrad with a creative thesis under your belt and some some big ideas.
Yeah, and people just started throwing paychecks at me.
But where did you get your first break? Were you at UCB at all, or did you just audition?
I did UCB, but I just wasn't that good at it.
Yeah.
I still like marvel really? At the... I mean, I loved it. I had so much fun doing it, but... And, I was like on teams. I did shows. I met my wife doing that stuff. And,
yeah.
But yeah, I couldn't for the life of me figure out how to like get on a house team or...
Right.
And I still like those guys that like to me are like... Those are the guys that you always talk about.
Zach,
looking at
Zach Woods.
Like Zach, watching Zach improvise.
Right.
Like he's a maestro.
How'd you get the first acting gigs? How'd you get an agent? Through UCB?
Nepotism.
Oh, really?
I moved out here. I was going to move to New York and try to do theater.
Right.
That was always what I thought I would do.
And yeah.
But my brother, my older brother, Mark, lived, Mark with a C.
Yeah.
Was living out here. He'd been out here for a while. And he's like, "Don't move to New York, dummy. Like, I, come out here." And then he just had this great big group of friends, then all of them doing different stuff, and two of them happened to be agents, and I was like, "Hey, what do I do?" And they're like, "Go to class." And they're like, "Okay, now what do I do?" And they're like, "Oh, like go on this audition." And then they're like, "Whoa, that went pretty bad. Go to more class." And they sort of like...
So they kind
of,
they sent you out?
They held my hand, yeah. Right. They held my hand a little bit.
Which classes did you do?
I did UCB and I did Groundlings, so I did the improv thing, and then I got involved at this place called Stan Kirsch Studios.
Uh-huh.
Which is sort of an off-spin of the Leslie Kahn megastar thing. And I spent a lot of time there, and I actually taught and coached there for a little while after I sort of like learned the thing a little bit.
How old are you?
Super old. 31.
That's good. Did a lot of shit.
Yeah, and
You're lucky.
I tutored and I bartended and I did all the things.
But you're lucky because it sounds to me with your sort of sensitivity and your sort of
neurosis.
It's neurosis, but you're pretty grounded, dude. But like it sounded like it was close. You could have ended up a teacher.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what I mean. Like you're one of those dudes that like you like the process and you know a lot and you're pretty good with people. That like it sounded like because that's one of the paths.
There but for you go I, Mark.
Yeah,
thanks for the job.
You can always go back to that. Just know that you can always teach.
Oh, I have one foot. Are you kidding me? Any minute, all of this is gone. This is surreal, but like this, like I mean, I just want to say this is crazy.
Yeah.
Like this is a rite of passage, obviously.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, this is real. But,
yeah.
But also, like, my image of the garage is like the fake garage. Oh, right.
From the show.
So like being in here, I'm like, oh, this is an interesting set. It sort of reminds me of what a real garage is like. But like,
it's the opposite. Well, I thought you'd come over here once. Maybe like I'm confusing memories.
Yeah,
maybe it was all over.
Invite
at
must
the
have
other
got lost
house.
In the mail.
No, that's not it. It just at some point I thought that maybe we came up here, but it was all my memories are confused as well. So the big head character just seems to be. You not like turning some things off that you turned on when you were doing my character. When you're playing Kyle, you're like full on, and then when they big head, you're like, I'm just gonna turn a couple knobs down.
That's really interesting. Yeah, it's
like you're literally
those are
like
the opposite ends of the spectrum of where I can exist.
Right. Yeah, you're just shut down and detached, and your tone doesn't shift as much. But whereas when you were Kyle, you're just sort of like all over the place.
I think that it's just you bring it out in me.
Yeah.
When we're together.
That's right, buddy. And how many episodes of Silicon Valley did you do to be not allowed to do my show?
Oh.
I guess I can frame that question differently. How many episodes are you in this season?
I don't know, six or seven.
Oh, that's
like
a lot.
That.
Okay, yeah. So maybe you really didn't have time.
I plead.
So this movie.
Yeah, Welcome to Happiness.
Welcome to Happiness. Now you did, you know, you've done a couple movies. One where it was hugely promoted and no one saw it. What was that called?
Yeah, I believe you're referring to The Internship.
Yeah, The Internship.
Not to be confused with The Intern, which is the exact same movie.
But did better or no?
I think they both did pretty bad.
The Internship. But there was a lot of post Josh Brenner images around town.
Oh, man, yeah, you couldn't.
Yeah, it was like the first season of Marin. I'm like, I guess he's going to be okay. I guess panned out for Kyle.
Yeah, and then, nothing. You know, yeah.
How many movies did you do after that?
Just like in, you know, most summers I'll do like a tiny indie or two, you know. I try to do stuff that won't come out as a general rule.
That's why I try to stay on networks that no one gets. I think it's a real good call. I think you're smart.
Oh, man, my parents figuring out IFC for the first time. They're like, Josh, okay, we're just going to go through the channel guide one by one together. Just stay on the phone.
I had a hard time finding it because I wanted to watch in real time this season. It's like 1,300 and something to get it. Like, I just
but it's got such good stuff on it.
I know.
That's it. It's crazy.
I know.
It's a great, like every, like I was, you know, when I watched the show and I'm like watching promos and like, you know, Comedy Bang Bang and Documentary Now. Like,
yeah,
it's like
Portlandia and
Portlandia,
then the movies and yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, who knows?
I don't know.
I'm detached from that.
The season is, by the way, like, I mean, I'm enjoying it more than ever because I hate watching myself on TV. So this season is like a real breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
But also, it's like you guys are doing something different.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm excited about it. Thank you.
You're making like cool, smart, hard to watch independent films that are also funny and sweet.
Well, thank you.
I love it, man.
I appreciate that.
It's so cool.
So tell me about this movie you're in because I didn't have time to watch it, and I don't even think I got the right movie.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Everybody's doing a great job. it's called Welcome to Happiness, and it's this first time director Oliver Thompson.
Where's he come from? What's his pedigree?
He's a Detroit fellow.
Oh, yeah?
Big Detroit sports guy.
Oh, okay.
And he's a musician, and he's a visual artist, and he's just like I'd never met a guy who, like, just knows all the, you know, like, he's also, like, one of these guys that can sort of, like, talk about everything.
Yeah.
You know, he, music, art, everything.
Yeah.
And, like, he just had this vision, and
it's his script?
It's his script, and he directed it, and he sort of developed it with one of the stars of the movie, Kyle Gallner, and it was just sort of this like group of people that I think just wanted to get together and be like, hey, let's make a movie.
What's it about?
It's sort of this magical realism thing. It's really about, you know, dealing with trauma and loss and past, you know, things that have happened in your life that you can't change.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, what if you could change them? And there's this magical element, and, you know,
plays the magic person?
Huh?
Is it a doorway or a ring or a fella?
It's a doorway. That's amazing that you just hit it. I was trying to come up with some joke about Aladdin and the lamp, and you just got it right.
It is a doorway.
It's a doorway. Yeah, it's a doorway. Man, that's so reductive. You walk in and Mark Maron just sizes up the whole freaking thing.
We got to get somewhere we can fix the past. There's got to be some portal.
Oh man,
some way of entering.
It's actually very sweet, and you know, there's great people in it. And
Nick Offerman's in it.
It's good people. Brendan Sexton is in it, and Keegan-Michael Key's in it.
I like him.
Yeah, he's the man.
Oh, Brendan Sexton. Yeah, I know that guy.
He's freaking amazing.
He's really good. I like this guy a lot.
We just went and saw, my wife and I just went and saw the movie. They had a little opening night thing.
How was it?
And we left, and she goes, man, that Brendan, wow.
Yeah?
And I said, yeah, anything else? And she's like, I mean, he's just like, you watch him, and he's just like, you're just on the journey with him. Oh, okay, cool. And like, what, like the rest of the movie was, yeah, man, really good performance. Oh, okay, cool.
What about
me? I love you too.
Me?
I love you too.
What about me? Is that what you said?
Well, I didn't, I just let my face do the what about me-ing.
Oh, I know this guy Kyle too. He's been in
things. I told you you'd know who he was.
Yeah.
No, it's like a really awesome cast, and like I said, Oliver
Padgett
and
Brewster's in it. She's good.
Yes, and she's awesome in it. Everybody's awesome in it.
Big cast.
Yeah, a lot of storylines.
And what, it's going to open where? Everywhere?
It's in town here. It's in
good.
North Hollywood at the
good.
Lamley, and it's like
good.
Places, you know, but yeah, fine. Just Google it.
It's a Lamley level movie.
That's correct.
That's good. That's where those
Your
movies
Your inflection
start.
Was wrong, though. You were supposed to go, oh, it's a Lamley-level movie.
Oh, let me try it again.
Yeah.
That's good note, though. It's a Lamley level movie.
Real perfect. Okay, that's a great take. Print that one. Circle it.
Thanks, man. Thanks for stopping by, buddy.
This was so nice of you. I can't believe it.
It's good to see you.
Thanks, man.
Not only is that kid a talented actor, he's a decent guy. That doesn't always happen in show business. He's a good man, that Josh Brenner. I like that guy. So this was very exciting. When I was in New York, I saw a lot of theater. A lot of you listen to the show know that I see theater. Lately, I've been encouraged and given the opportunity and taken care of, which I don't mind. But Stephen Karam's play, The Humans, is now on Broadway at the Helen Hayes Theater. It's nominated for 6 Tony Awards, including Best Play. Now, this was a very intimate, very interesting, very real-feeling play about a family. It all takes place over the course of basically one Thanksgiving dinner where a young couple has the woman's parents over and her sister. And it sounds all very simple, and it feels very simple, but it's very haunting and very deep. And very emotional and very funny. And I've just really enjoyed going to see theater. And I'd like to make time to do more of that kind of stuff. Just more stuff. You know, we all know what the stuff we're supposed to do is and that it's supposed to be fun. But sometimes just the idea of getting there makes it a little tricky. But I did go to see The Humans. And I did have Stephen Karam come to my hotel room in New York City the last time I was there. We had a very nice conversation, as I recall. So this is me and playwright Stephen Karam.
I think we need to open by congratulating you on your Tony nomination.
Thank you very much.
I'm saying that
just happened.
Yeah, it just happened.
Yeah.
Like an hour ago?
Like an hour ago, yeah.
So what were the phone calls rolling in? Scott Rudin? Oh my God. You deserve it. We knew it.
Scott did call. Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, agents, I just talked to my parents.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, they were watching, you know, it's all so silly, but my parents were watching, I guess it was on CBS.
Uh-huh.
You know, being, you know, of my generation, I was live streaming it.
Yeah.
Like from the website, but they were watching, I guess, Charlie Rose and that CBS morning show.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And so my mom was most excited that there was a passing comment that she overheard from Charlie about having seen the play or something to that effect. So that's what we just talked about.
Oh, that's that's nice. They love Charlie Rose.
Of course they do. Yeah.
I was just there yesterday. Have you done it?
I'm actually doing it later this afternoon.
Yeah. Oh, great.
With the cast, with Jane and Reed Birney,
who played the parents in the
Humans. And Joe Mantello, who directed it. So.
Joe Mantello's been around for a while, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's like the guy.
Brilliant guy. I think it's a modern miracle that a play like this has made it to Broadway. Do you know what I mean?
I know. I saw it at, where did I see it? At
the Roundabout? Celebrities. You saw it off-Broadway at the Roundabout Theater Company, yeah.
So that's a very intimate space. And the set itself is very intimate and kind of compartmentalized, specifically.
Yeah. It's big and small at the same time.
It's
like
an apartment.
A two-level set.
Right.
But yeah, it's your classic New York duplex apartment, which means ultimately not very, ground floor basement,
right?
One window.
All very familiar to me.
All very familiar to me. I mean, that's pretty much a slightly adjusted version of an apartment I lived in for 6 years.
Yeah. In New York, and you just sit there and go like, this is good for New York. This is great. It's only $5,000.
What's so funny it was a good price. I was splitting it with someone else. And like the apartment in the play, they had their own entrances, on both floors.
Yeah.
So it was the perfect roommate apartment because we each had our own bathroom, too.
Oh, that's good. But now
everyone seeing the play thinks, you know, like, this is a terrible apartment. And I was so happy in that apartment. I couldn't believe that I could turn around. This was my first queen size bed.
It looked like you had a kitchen.
It did have a kitchen, yeah. One that hadn't been renovated in about 20, 25 years, but...
Well, that's always the trick in New York, is it a kitchen or is it just a nook where there's a stove and no room to do nothing?
I've exclusively had nooks.
Yeah.
To date.
And you can't cook.
Yeah.
That's why New York restaurants are like always popular and always have people eating at them. Even the worst ones is because no one looks at their kitchen in New York City and goes like, I'm going to cook in there.
Right.
Like it's got to be a real, you got to be sick or something to even make anything. It's a chore. But how does it, when you, what, well, let's start at the beginning then. So you wrote a few plays before this, before The Humans.
I did, yeah.
But it looks like a couple of them you wrote in college.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd been writing, I wrote plays in college that I would probably not want to own necessarily. Maybe like the one that you did, but yeah, I started writing, I mean, I was even writing like sketches and things as a, like comedy sketches as a kid in high school. Like
really?
As a teenager.
Yeah. That's where it started, the craving or the compulsion to write dialogue?
Yeah, I didn't know that it was, I wasn't pursuing writing as a profession then, but I just... You know, I was growing up in Scranton. There wasn't a lot going on.
Scranton,
PA.
I don't have no point of reference for that other than the sign.
Well, you
on
probably
the train,
do.
Right?
You know, so Scranton's it's the home of the American version of The Office.
Yeah.
You know, Joe Biden. A lot of politicians have connections to Scranton, sure. So that's usually how people know it.
Isn't that the sign you see when you're taking the train? Is Scranton, the city of industry or something, or the city
of the
something?
Electric city?
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
You know, but. You know, Steamtown. It's right. All of its ties are to, you know, industry and you know, trains and that are no longer necessarily in service. So, but you know, my
little
mom,
little rusted out.
You know, the heaps of the, what do you call it? The coal, the leftover, the
piles of coal.
Yeah, the big piles of black. Mountains of coal dirt. Yeah.
The one thing I remember about Pennsylvania is if you ever drove cross country, at some point you're like, holy shit, Pennsylvania is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. People are always like, I have a friend in Pittsburgh. They don't realize that Pittsburgh to Scranton is about, you know, maybe 8 hours or something.
So why were you there? What did you were about to say about your mother?
Well, I grew up. Why was I in Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Well, that's where I was born and raised. What do you mean?
Well, I know, but why were your parents in Pennsylvania?
Oh, you mean how did they end up there?
Yeah.
That's where they were born. My dad's side of the family is really fascinating. So I'm half Lebanese, half Irish. My dad's dad, my grandfather, was born in Lebanon, came here when he was about 25, died speaking only broken English when my dad was 17. But my dad's one of 10.
Wow.
He's 9 of 10. So, my oldest uncle... who's passed away recently, he's sort of like the godfather of the family and kind of like my grandfather.
Yeah.
You know, he was born in Lebanon too. So it almost feels like it's one of those families where via my aunts and uncles, there's like multiple generations even in one family unit because there are 10 of them.
Right.
So the age gap is pretty, you know, big.
And you're growing up in this sort of...
They came here because of the Maronite... A parish, you know, there was a Lebanese American community here in it's sort of the Lebanese version of Roman Catholicism.
I know, and it's exactly spelled like my name, Maronite.
It actually is.
Yeah, people take pictures of those churches sometimes and send them to me and go like, "You have a following."
Let me know if you ever get St. Anne's Maronite in Scranton. That's
I don't remember. I don't know if I took a picture of that one. Where did I see one? Maybe.
Detroit has a population of a lot of
but you grew up in like with this side of the family that it was exotic by American standards, I would say, like at least with customs and traditions and cuisine.
Yeah, you're going to church and yeah, the Our Fathers and Aramaic, and there's this, but at the same time what's funny about Scranton is maybe it's because I was part of such a close-knit family, it didn't feel weird.
Yeah.
As I got older, I started to feel maybe a little aware of how maybe uncool it felt, you know, when you're becoming at an age where you're like, oh, maybe this is weird that, you know, the parish that I belong to and the customs and everything. But Scranton is also kind of just a hodgepodge of so many different
ethnicities
and churches everywhere that, you know, in some ways I felt weirder being like a gay kid than I did being a Maronite Christian.
yeah. I guess one trumps the other.
Yeah.
Like there's a certain level of tolerance for ethnicity differences, but there can be a blanket intolerance for gayness.
Yeah. And Scranton's so weird because it's so close to New York City, right?
Yeah.
It's like 2.5 hours.
Oh, that doesn't matter.
But
Yeah.
It was just, it was like the especially the time, like I just missed the cutoff. There was no like gay straight alliance. And there's no like.
Just before everything started sort of.
A little, yeah, just kind of just missed that wave. And it's just, you know, there's no Amtrak to get into New York City. So people in Scranton really don't take advantage of the city.
People on Long Island don't, buddy.
Okay, so that's good to know. I thought that was a Scranton thing.
Oh, no. You go out on the island, they're like, nah, we don't go to Manhattan. Because when I got booked to do shows on Long Island, I'm like, aren't they just going to come to my New York City show? And they're like, no. They're
totally separate audience.
Kind of.
Yeah.
What business was your dad in?
My dad, are you ready for this? He was the high school principal of my public school, of the public school I attended.
Uh-huh.
So he was a history teacher, turned vice principal, and then for the last, 15, 20 years of his career, he was a principal.
He was the principal?
Yeah, of my
So you went to school with your dad.
And a big public high school, too.
Oh, so that's a rough gig.
Yeah. It wasn't the easiest.
Being a warden.
You know, what's funny is kids just say stuff to you like your dad just gave me detention, you know, yeah. And they'd like, you know, slam your locker. You. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of stuff like that. I wasn't actually ever
answering for the sins of your father.
Well, it's, yeah, and you can't really say anything to it. So I kind of just kept my head down, and my sister was older than me. She was 4 years older.
Just two of you?
Three of us.
Yeah.
And she was a lot cooler than I was.
Yeah.
So I think she, in some ways, probably helped pave the way. She was a senior when I was a freshman, and so there was a kind of, I think maybe enough people knew her that people just left me alone a little bit.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But that is a strange experience.
Yeah.
You know.
So when you started, did you start doing theater in high school?
I did, yeah. I didn't always get cast in the shows, but I was in a production of The Music Man. I was a co-sound chair for our production of Count Dracula.
Uh-huh. So you were a theater guy.
I was a theater guy. I also did, even nerdier than being a theater guy, I did speech and debate.
Uh-huh.
Are you aware of what that is?
I know about it, and it's one of those things where whenever I talk to somebody who had experience with speech and debate, that I'd like to know the tactics of it.
Well, like, there's all these different kinds. I think you'd actually be really good at it. I feel like people who can do stand-up comedy, I mean, the bravery that it takes to do stand-up comedy especially, I feel like you're perfectly poised for success.
Yeah, but everything becomes very personal to me. As soon as I feel that I'm losing an argument, it becomes like, you know, fuck you, you're stupid.
I think that would make you a really exciting Lincoln Douglas debater, actually.
Well, you did a play called Speech and Debate about.
I did. That was one of my first. Yeah.
About high school kids.
About high school kids.
Struggling
with
things.
Struggling with issues and things. So it's a comedy.
But when were you like comfortably gay? I mean, did that happen in high school? I mean, or were you one of those sort of like hiding in the theater department, kind of like not quite out people?
I was pretty much one of those hiding in the theater department, but I also was one of those weirdos who was sort of just asexual before I came. I didn't have this trail of girlfriends.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I did not break a lot of hearts.
Okay.
So, you know, I was the kid that was taking his best female friends to all of the dances and the proms.
Right.
You can just follow like a slew of pictures of me with, you know, my best girlfriends.
Right.
And then I came out to one close friend in college when I was like 18.
Uh-huh.
And then I came out to my family and pretty much everyone later when I was 20 or 21.
How'd they handle it?
Shockingly well, actually. And I think part of it was because my parents really did know me,
as did
my friends.
Right.
And again, a little mysterious when you make it to 21 without...
Without coming out?
Without a lot of sexual conquests or even like, I have a crush on this, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't think I was, shocking anyone.
Yeah.
You know? I had also sung like a Miss Saigon song when I was 14 in a talent show. So I feel like I was paving the way very early on.
Finally, they were like, finally.
Yeah.
We can all relax.
I feel like in college, that was the reaction.
Yeah.
And strangely from Scranton, you know, you do realize that because... You know, my parents didn't have gay friends, or there was no real visibility of a
community
of a gay community. Yeah. That a lot of people did just think that I was a straight kid who was into musical theater and
the only
singing
gay community
songs,
was
you know?
The theater department at your high school.
Exactly, and I found it.
Good. And it wasn't that dangerous, you know, and it wasn't, you know, it was nice. We, you know, everyone felt well supported.
Of course, you know, you can be your weirdo self. And
So when did you start the writing? When did that feel like? You said you started in high school writing sketches, but what inspired you to do that? I mean,
just other stuff that made me laugh. I mean, I actually remember just loving a lot of even, I did discover plays in high school, and I'd seen Little Shop of Horrors when I was in first grade. My sister was in a production at North Scranton Intermediate School. So I was kind of vaguely aware that there was this thing called theater. But really, it was even, I mean, I remember writing sketches after watching Sherry O'Terry and Will Ferrell do stuff that just really made me laugh on Saturday Night Live. And fooling around in my basement with my friend Kim and, you know, writing sketches for class day and stuff. But in terms of, like, you know, we read The Crucible in high school, and I kind of started to get jazzed as to, like, just what was out there. So I started reading a lot of plays, and then I started imitating a lot of the, every writer that would come along that would kind of blow my mind, I would sort of do the classic.
You write like them for a while.
Yeah, embarrassing imitation of,
And that's part of a speech and debate, right? Don't they do a version of The Crucible? Or
they do, actually. The one of the girls, she writes a pop musical version of The Crucible, told from the perspective of Mary Warren, one of the girls who
was a bully, or
she's kind of the bully. Right. She's
so you're exercising your demons of style.
Exactly.
But the thing that fascinates me about theater, and the thing that, like, you know, as somebody who is relatively sophisticated and understands, you know, why theater should be important, and wondering whether or not it is as important as it was, or was it ever really, is that I finally realized day before yesterday is that, you know, New York is theater in a lot of ways. And that, you know, whether anybody goes to see the theater or not, if a play becomes successful, it has a resonance throughout the culture. It may take time, and it may take different forms, but it starts a dialogue, you know, in a lot of different other forms.
I think that's right, yeah. Yeah.
But it seems to me that people like you and Annie and Lynn, you know, that there's a generation of people that is, you know, whether intentionally or not, you know, making theater accessible to a generation of people that may have not necessarily dismissed it, but not thought it was part of their lives.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of every generation is, you know, writers are trying to put things on stage that mean something to them, or the kind of plays that they'd want to see. So, that's what I think we do. You know, I don't think it's a conscious choice of trying to be, to necessarily, like, bring a new wave of theater to a generation, as we're all just, you know, where we're at in our lives. And
you are the generation, and if you can get them to come, great.
And exactly.
And they seem to be coming.
Yeah. I mean, all you can do is put, I mean, it's probably where your stand-up comes from, too, is just, it's like you can only talk about the stuff that's on your mind
that's
keeping you up at night and hope that maybe other people are thinking about those things, too. Right?
Well, I'm fortunate in that, you know, I'm emotionally somewhat stunted. And, you know, I'm a 52-year-old man, twice divorced with no kids, and a fairly infantile emotional structure. So, like, fortunately for me, that when my success, you know, actually started happening in my late 40s, that, you know, I was just as appealing to 45-year-olds as I was to 15-year-olds who were having emotional problems. There's a continuity there. You know, there's a
huge market.
Well, yeah, I'm on
human beings with emotional problems. I think it's also why theater exists.
It's a big spectrum.
It's a big spectrum.
But even the decision that, you know, it seems to me that, you know, when you talk about, for whatever reason, you were, you know, interested in theater in high school, or you found a sort of community in that, that as it became more sophisticated and as you get older, you know, that community has a different depth to it and a different intensity to it. But you still felt that, you know, this was a world that, you know, your creativity could thrive in, and that you wanted to live in.
Yeah.
So when did you know that?
It was such a slow process. I mean, the truth is, I come from a family where there are no artists or people making their living as an artist.
Right.
So it wasn't like I graduated from college and thought I'd become a playwright.
Right.
It was really just, I was so drawn to theater that I kept doing it in college. I kept writing. I graduated.
You kept acting or just writing?
I did act in college, but college is where I started acting less and writing more.
And when
you... I had a lot of stage fright, so it was actually
it was
clear to me that I was not going to have a career as an actor.
But it's good that you got up there so you could understand it feels like to be up there as a director and as a writer.
Hands down, it's made me, to this day, I think it's the best writer training I've had was just having been in a lot of plays.
Right.
Even completely amateurish, college theater. Sure. I think it's the best preparation. I'm astonished anytime a writer says that they haven't been on that side, because I think it instantly makes you a better writer when you know what it is to have to make sense of someone else's words.
Yeah, and take the risks that are necessary.
And take those risks.
Yeah.
You just have a better understanding, not only of what you're asking of actors, but you've just worn the other hat. So
So when you were in college, I imagine that, outside of what you experienced in high school and seeing musicals or being in musicals and doing, that level of theater, that, or even seeing a version of the, or a, what's the word I want? A play done amateurly.
Sure.
Like a big play. There must have been a moment where you saw something in a real theater production that made you go like, holy fuck, that the power of that is very specific.
It's interesting. There wasn't a lightning flash moment like that, only because I remember being obsessed with The Glass Menagerie because we had read it and I had seen a production at Scranton Public Theater.
Yeah.
But those moments of like feelings of electricity really came from reading a lot of plays, which I know is weird.
I have a hard time.
But my first theater experiences, professional theater experiences, were where the Scranton High School different clubs wouldn't get on the bus to see a big Broadway musical. So my first show was Phantom of the Opera, my first Broadway show. So it wasn't that those experiences weren't amazing for me. They were. It was just I didn't walk out of Phantom of the Opera being like, I've got to write another,
Phantom of the Opera.
I've got to create something as, I've got to create a heroine as potent as Christine Daae.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was really like a slow burn in terms of discovering, like at the drama bookshop, like my mom would take me in and I'd have, X amount of dollars to buy these acting editions that were really cheap. So a lot of the first kind of thrill of what theater could be was like reading, a play like Angels in America, as opposed to
seeing it.
Yeah, being like 15 and having seen.
That's interesting. So the first kind of resonating experience was to see the words.
Yeah, because my first professional productions were like 15 years into the runs of these mega musicals. So it was like, people were like, essentially like out to lunch during the, sure. I saw it with one production of Miss Saigon, it was a matinee, and you could tell the poor actors were just like
done.
They were just done. They were like, we have to do this again at 8 o'clock. This is like, we have to go back to Ho Chi Minh City. It's just the whole Saigon's going to fall again, tonight.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there is something funny about that element of theater. Like even like, cause I went to see Hamilton last night and then I went backstage and they were just sort of like, hey, what's going on? I'm like, hey, you guys okay? like there's part of me that's sort of like, you need to sit down for a minute.
But do you sense how they're kind of wired to, like, I feel like post show, even when you're doing even if you're doing Long Day's Journey into Night, right?
Yeah.
There's a kind of, it's hard to sleep after.
Oh yeah, no, even after a big comedy performance, you're looped. You're just lit. Yeah, yeah, I get it.
It's that kind of thing.
But you mentioned like Long Day's Journey into Night, like, because I, after watching The Humans and after thinking about it, and after seeing, Louis, Horace, and Pete, which I think, for all practical purposes is theater, that it seems that the line between tragedy and comedy in contemporary theater, which with my experience of it is basically you and Annie, is in some ways, which is very contemporary. You're both, you were up for a Pulitzer. You just got nominated for Tony for Best Play. I mean, this is real shit here. So... But when you think about Long Day's Journey into Night, and you think about those generational familial, tragedies that are purely, you're going into darkness, in a way that you may not recover from.
Well, what's
structurally?
I did not approach this play from that place.
No, I know that.
That's what's so interesting is I thought I was writing a psychological thriller or a pure genre kind of.
But I don't think it is a tragedy in the same way, or even can be categorized like that. That's why I'm sort of curious about, you know, transcending these forms. That there is this area, you know, between, you know, very specifically comedy and very specifically dark.
Between dark and light.
Yeah, that, but doesn't sort of, you know, move towards death.
Yeah.
I mean, it does metaphorically on some level, like anything does.
Sure.
But yet, you know, at the end of The Humans, you know, they're...
A measure of hope.
There's a measure of hope, and
a moment of grace.
And it is literal darkness.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you don't really know what it means, but it can suggest a lot of things. But, you know, no one's going down for the count.
Right. But it ends with a moment of grace. I mean,
right. Yeah. Because I imagine that when you do a family drama like that, you know, the sort of specter of O'Neill is always sort of there, right? In a way.
Sure. And all the great
American
family plays are there. But that's why I feel lucky that I don't think I would have written it if I was thinking, if I was approaching the play, thinking of that kind of canon, right. You know what I mean? I don't think any writer would.
What those are plays some of the other ones in your mind?
Oh, well, Long Day's Journey,
right?
Death of a Salesman,
right?
Arthur Miller,
yeah.
The Glass Menagerie,
right?
Raisin in the Sun,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the list goes on and on.
Sure.
You can sort of chart an interesting line of, you know, but from one to the next.
But as you evolve through your first few, you know, published plays, I have to assume that there was a learning curve there for you.
Oh, huge. And there still is. I still feel like I finished The Humans, and it's never that you want to disown your past work, but you know how it goes. It's especially being a young writer, from Speech and Debate to Sons of the Prophet to The Humans, there's a huge learning curve. And so it's kind of like looking at school pictures.
Yeah, you want to move past it.
You want to move past it, but you also don't want to mess with them. It's like you don't want to like take the braces off of the photo or the bad haircut. It's a reflection of who you were at the time, which is actually in some ways kind of makes them perfect in their imperfections. You know, if I went back to try to fix my older plays, I think I'd damage them in some way even more, you know, in my attempt to fix them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Have you seen different productions of your older plays? I mean, it's one of the weird...
I have seen a few productions of them, but I also try to support them from afar with love. And, you know, sometimes I feel like I am a bit of a control freak, so I like to either be totally involved, meaning let me be involved in casting and being able to talk with the designers and have a relationship with the director. And if I can't have that, part of me is just, you know, happy to know that the show is going to open in Detroit in this production, and I can wish it well from afar.
Right.
And it's not because I think they are going to quote unquote mess it up. It's just,
it's out of your hands.
It's out of your hands.
Yeah.
And so in some ways I feel like the experience that other people would have watching it, is the right experience. And mine would be so warped by, you know, my experience of just showing up on opening night would be like, why did they? Yeah.
Yeah, can I talk to you for a minute?
Costume shouldn't be. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's overacting. What's happening? Why is she crying so much? You know, you know, all the things you can do when you're actually involved in a rehearsal process.
Right.
So,
but it's interesting as a writer. Do you think that somebody can discover things within your work that you might not have seen? And
yeah, I think that's why I'm a playwright. I mean, there's nothing more exhilarating than, you know, I mean, then when somebody, the idea that somebody years from now can take your work and reinvent it, or that even like a high school kid's amateur productions can find a spark or a life or an angle or something about it that, you know, based on the timing of when they do it and who those human beings are that are bringing it to life and putting on those roles. I mean, there's nothing like that. You know, it exists as literature, but really it can be rediscovered again and again and again.
Yeah. So you went to Brown?
I went to Brown.
How was that experience? That's like the sort of groovy Ivy League school, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was weird. No one from my high school had ever gone there. And so it wasn't even I was so you know, I was crazy anxious to get out of Scranton. And yeah. so I was just that kid that was just ready to
had enough
go of see the world.
The coal piles?
a little bit. yeah. And so I had like, you know, no one had even read my application. I researched all the schools that I wanted to, you know, and but people weren't even, you know, no one thought it was like a good thing that I was going to Brown. They thought it was like a 2-year like VCR repair, you know, program or something. It was basically like, what even is
Brown?
And then I went to Brown and, you know, there were all these people who were surprised I hadn't heard of their high schools, which I thought was fascinating. It was a whole like cultural education.
Oh, sort of like preschool, nurse,
people, you know, who had been to like, I even forget the names of it, but you know, like the school in DC, you know, my roommate had gone to where, you know, he was in school with like the president's, the vice, yeah. Al Gore's
sure.
kids. And,
yeah.
And oh, people yeah, you, were like, you don't know about, you know, this school or this school. And I just thought it was so weird that people, that anyone would be expected to know of someone's high school.
Well, there's a whole, like my buddy Sam, Sam Lipside, he's a novelist. You know, he's got kids, and you got to start thinking about that shit when they go to kindergarten.
But like, you know, when trajectory. You grow up and you go to public school, it's and it's never even a thought of. It's right. like, well, of course you're gonna you go to the elementary school that's near you.
Yeah, in the public school.
Then that's you go to East Scranton Intermediate School, and you go to Scranton High School. It's like, what's and then you go to, you know, you come to New York, and it's a whole.
Oh yeah, people are moving, and they're like
paying like, you know, $40,000-$50,000 a year for elementary school education,
yeah.
and you know.
Just so
mind blowing to me. So for me, college was both. Brown was incredible, and it's sort of where I feel like I came into my own. But I feel like I was just doing a lot of growing up. I was a type A, you know, good student, but I was a little scared of my creative side. So it was kind of great to be in a place that it was really, you had really easy access to, you know, even like mounting your own production, student run theater,
yeah.
and kids. I'm talking like kids from the, you know, computer science department were doing theater. Everybody was kind of, it did have a really kind of exciting artistic vibe.
What
Chris Hayes, MSNBC, Chris Hayes, we were doing theater together at Brown. And
and Lin too?
And well, no, Lin-Manuel was at Wesleyan.
Because I know, him and Chris.
They went to high school together.
That's
yeah,
right.
Which is amazing.
It's weird how Chris Hayes plays into this weird kind of young theater world.
Chris you know Hayes that? Is changing the face of American theater.
Right. Yeah. It's very curious to me that, like, because I think he really wants to, like, I think there he might do it eventually.
He was a great director. I remember him. He directed a student-written musical in high school. He even then, he had a kind of, he had what it took to be a good director. Like, everybody trusted him.
Yeah.
Great personality.
And he's a very empathetic sort.
Completely empathetic, yeah. which is what you need. You
right.
know? So.
But
I actually hope he did. That would be amazing if he actually did come back to the theater world.
It would be great.
Yeah.
You're the guy to bring him back. You and Lin, bring Chris Hayes back to the director's chair. So, what do you mean you were scared of your creative side?
I mean, I don't know what your situation was, how you got, you know, into the arts, but I feel like I was so practical about how would I earn a living.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I came from a family where you know, we were sort of very careful with like spending and stuff, and so it also felt like I felt a real panic about how would I even continue to pursue this in any legitimate way. And you know, I ended up just moving here and getting a job as a paralegal and working for like 8 or 9 years in that capacity while I continued to write. I opened my first few plays and just went back to work the next day because I just needed that. I mean, I wish I had a badass story.
Yeah.
I actually needed security and knowing that I could would have health insurance and rent money to be able to be wild and creative and free in my writing.
It's interesting that there are fewer and fewer badass stories.
Are there?
Generationally.
Yeah.
But yeah, because, you know, no one's fucking around as much as they used to. You know what I mean? You better be showing up for work,
yeah.
and capable of doing the job. You know, there's the capacity for producers, I think, and for audiences to tolerate you know,
yeah.
the badass story has become limited because the cultural lexicon of when someone's fucked up is right. like, you know, well, this is too bad. you know what I mean? It's not like, yeah, man, he's out there. Or like, you know, like,
yeah.
or you get these playwright stories like he's drinking himself to death, but he's doing these great things. It's like, I don't think anyone gives a fuck about that anymore. And they're just sort of like, well, good luck, you know?
That's
I
mean, funny.
It happens subversively and sadly now. You know, a lot of that stuff happens behind closed doors and people are shocked when they hear about it. But, you know, in the 70s, when Sam Shepard and Patti Smith were running around doing whatever the hell they were doing, they were like, fuck yeah, rock and roll. I think it's a much more professional environment in some ways.
Yeah. Do you think social media has kind of ruined that too?
Like there social media, if not, I think...
it's created a consciousness about it because it is, you know, I read John Lahr wrote this incredible biography of Tennessee Williams.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kazan has an amazing autobiography. But you read like those accounts of those artistic lives and it does feel badass and amazingly scary and wild in a way that does seem rare. I mean, now that you're saying that,
I think that something has happened. I think that,
but that stuff wasn't in the spotlight like while it was happening, is I guess what I'm saying.
The constant surveillance by passersby, the inability to have any, you know, real private life, you know, like I imagine, you know, if there was more than three people hanging around Tennessee Williams, one of them would be tweeting about the party.
Totally. So, well, even this feels like really exposing. I mean, because part of me is like, I write plays like that. My plays feel about as personal as I want to get in terms of sharing info about my like emotional landscape or what's going on. So even this feels really bizarre.
Right. Well, this is it's long form. I think that, you know what I mean? This is not some quick hit. And I think that there were times where these type of conversations were had.
Yeah.
And I think they were had with people like Tennessee Williams. I think that, you know, not to compare myself, but Studs Terkel and people who were felt to be chronicling, you know, the emotional and creative ebbs and flows of artists, you know, was around. And I think this is old style. I don't know if it was ever done specifically like this. But I think that the attention span to take something like this in and process it is relatively new again, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I think just getting back to the badass, you know, stories is that when you read those biographies, don't you have that moment where you're like, that not only were they geniuses, but they had some physical perseverance and tolerance that seems almost inhuman.
Absolutely.
I mean, when you hear about like Tennessee Williams or even about, you know, the British actors who are shit-faced, you know, all the fucking time.
Yeah.
Could you even imagine, you know, yourself like at one of your plays, you know, your lead actor is just like drunk again?
Yeah.
You know, what would you do? You'd be like, we got to replace that guy.
Absolutely. Me, especially, Mark, fired. There's enough drama that goes on in mounting an original play that I can't even imagine.
But if you had a producer who said, I don't know, maybe you think twice about this. He's going to bring people in, you know, and he'll hit 8 out of 10. 8 out of 10.
Of course. And especially if it's Scott Rudin saying that to you, you know, you got to trust it. You do it. And, you know, it's funny, the Glass Menagerie story, one of them, I think it almost... It sort of frames the narrative around it in the Lahr biography is, I believe, the actress who played Amanda Wingfield, I forget her name now, she's famous. Anyway, I believe she puked in the wings like before. She was so nervous. You hear these stories and I'm like, I can't imagine getting a rehearsal report that's like, you know, Jane Houdyshell, you know, drinking, puking in the wings before, but you know, right before first entrance. I mean, I don't know. I honestly think I would have to just leave the city until the run was over because I wouldn't know where to put the anxiety and the stress that would come from like show to show.
You're nervous enough.
Well, theater is so, that's what makes it so magic is that you never know what's going to happen every time the cast steps out on the stage. Every show's a little different and a little, you know, so it's always a tightrope walk. But you add that element of like a drug problem or is this person going to show up, you know,
drug.
Semi-conscious. then you're really going out on the deep end.
Well, I think at that time the entire community was living on the edge a little like that.
Yeah.
That they were insulated in their way of life, which is not really possible now.
Yeah,
and everybody was sort of in on it. Like you know, I think that it had to have been like a lot of times that the celebration at the end of the show was like we made it through.
Right. And like the culture around drinking was also different, or the consciousness about something maybe about alcoholism. I mean, it seems like the envelope was before somebody was like, you have a serious drinking problem.
Right.
It seemed to exist a lot of leeway seemed to exist.
That's right.
Between.
Yeah. Well, there's and I wonder how that's like you sort of changed. I do think that because of expectations and because of things needing to be new and you know, sort of immediately powerful. that, you know, people have become very jaded, especially with content and with things, and you know, like, and especially when they hear hype about things, they really want it to live up to everything. Everybody has this weird sense of broad entitlement, you know, that there's no real tolerance
for. Tell me about it. Yeah.
Yeah, said the guy who was nominated for a Pulitzer and now nominated for a
No, title. I just mean that's, I feel like anybody who makes anything has that experience of,
oh, yeah.
Even when it goes really well and you feel like you've had the dream experience, you realize then that if there can be said to be a downside to any form of success, and of course it's relative, so it's not actually a downside. It's
right.
All just, it's like the best problem in the world, is that when people go to see something that they're told is great, they are going with their own, creating their own expectations and baggage, and if it doesn't actually line up to their what they had decided it was going to be before they saw it,
yeah,
suddenly a play that they might have liked if they had just discovered it becomes like, this is not as good as Death of a Salesman. And it's like, well, the play's ambition was not to be a reality show competition, right. You know,
against. yeah and you got to put that stuff out of your head. It's not on you.
Oh, of course, yeah. It's not your job. Your job is to just, you know, try to tell the truth.
So, yeah, well, walk me through that a little bit, in that, you know, the play, The Humans, and the creation of it, you know, that, you know, what you've woven into this thing, you know, is sort of the cute kind of new couple experience of, you know, getting this new apartment,
yeah,
and, you know, the sort of strains of being a young couple and what one's going to do and what the other's doing, and then the parents come in, then all of a sudden there's you know, a very definitive 9/11 specter hanging over it, and then there's, you know, there is a gay, not gay struggle element, but a gay character that has a personal struggle that is, you know, it's not deadly, but it's concerning. And a bit embarrassing. And then you have, you know, these parents, the mother who's sort of, you know, a kind of like, you know, fully, you know, kind of engaged and overbearing religious denial person who does charitable things.
Sure.
I'm just trying to remember.
Yeah, and then you're actually doing a good job. Yeah.
The matriarch who is completely Alzheimer'd.
Yeah,
and impulsive, without any control of what she's contributing to the event.
You're depressing me just saying all these things.
No, and then you have this sort of father who, you know, is trying to be strong, but is carrying his own burden of you know, a financial burden and a personal burden.
And to me, they actually seem like a relatively stable family in some ways too, which is what I think
what's the point.
Weird and strange, and maybe the interesting counter to everything that you just said, which is true. Like, all those problems do exist in their lives.
But the counter to it is that there's love there.
I think they're an oddly functional family for all of their dysfunction, you know?
Uh-huh.
I think part of me was interested in exploring, like, the existential horrors of what felt like a very ordinary and loving family.
Right.
As opposed to, like, maybe the big issue being like, would these people actually kill each other by the end of the night, or you know, hurl pieces of furniture at each other? It's I think it's less about questioning their, let's say, like, unconditional love for each other, and I think the play is more fascinated in the ways each of them are coping, or let's say not coping so well, with these basement level fears.
Basement level have. where we're at.
Well, and they're literally stuck in the basement,
but
it's this apartment.
But it's nice.
I maintain that is an amazing apartment, and I feel like I get embarrassed every time I confess this, but Mark, there's a lot of space in that apartment.
No, I'm with you.
Queen size bed. You can fit a queen size bed in that alcove.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great apartment.
I think spiral staircases are great, as, you know, I didn't have any, like, art to put on the walls. And so for me, I even thought that was like a beautiful piece of sculpture.
Sure. Yeah. No,
I could put lights on it in Christmas time.
I like the apartment. But did you just, now, you couldn't have just made that connection between basement level problems and the basement level set.
I think my subconscious made the connection.
Uh-huh.
I mean, now I'm making the connection. Yeah. No, but I mean, I'm always thinking of it as like what's in the basement? Fears. Well, yeah, that, like what's in the basement.
But I like that because that's like, you know, when I'm growing up or when you, I don't know what kind of house you grew up in, but like my grandmother's house had this basement that was terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's boxes.
Well, basements aren't terrifying. Right. I mean, I guess some people have finished basements.
And but there is like, I didn't just realize it. There was like the basement went into this other back room that I'm like, I'm not going in there. And there's nothing in there. It's just a room with shelves. And like, and then you'd go in there and it'd be like three weird old pictures just laying on a shelf. And
oh,
like,
totally. And genuine, like spiders do amazing work in basements. Like
oh,
my basement.
LA, they do amazing work everywhere.
Do
they? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, my basement, there would be just extraordinary like cobwebs and... you know, because it just wasn't lived in. It wasn't finished. And even just the smell of like, you know, when you feel like the concrete floor and the... But
you weren't that aware in constructing the play of what happened on the upper level and what happened on the lower level.
I think something interesting happened to me by living in a place that was literally below ground for 6 years, where you actually were looking outside and couldn't tell even on a sunny day, was it sunny? Was it cloudy? Was it... I think something did seep in terms of storing away that it something about that setting did feel really spectacular because it both felt utterly naturalistic and like my favorite kind of set pieces that element of not knowing what's outside or knowing there's a whole world out there, but actually not being able to access any of it, just seeing a brick wall. And it felt very meta and numinous and kind of like the thing that theater could exploit in a really quiet way.
Yeah.
Like just having, you know, around David's Inn set, it's just voided. It's just black. It's not the set with like the hints of the Lower East Side around signs of Chinatown. And I think that works a kind of quiet magic on that. Those are the things that I don't expect an audience to process in any conscious way. But I do think that theater can, you know, normally I'm a fan of non-realistic sets because I think those really do glean the cosmos in a kind of amazing way. But I feel like you can also, there's something I was excited about with this play, to play with real architecture that slowly got voided. It sort of starts in a very bizarre white void, creamy white, like pre-war, you know, the way they slab white paint on everything.
Sure. Yeah.
And slowly as the lights go out, you actually do get back to a kind of a black stage.
Oh yeah.
This is how I was thinking about stuff and dreaming about the play. It's not anything that I think anyone should be noting or a conscious experience.
But this is like the evolution of the discovery of you know in your creative process. That like, cuz the more I talk to writers, that you know, where do you start, you know, like you said that Ian, when we talked about the subconscious, that you know, what are the seeds for something like The Humans? Cuz The Humans are very disarming, very intimate. And very, you know, there's a lot of, I don't want to say humanity, but you walk into a situation, I think almost anybody, you know, whether it's from their past or their kids' past, where you're like, you're familiar with this. You know, right away, you're like, oh, these people are our neighbors, or these people, you're familiar with, there's no sort of like, what the fuck is happening here?
Right.
Until things move on.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of like disarming and almost like, you know, it's almost organic that you know, that you feel like you're eavesdropping on, you know, what is this first meeting of, or maybe the first meeting of the kid, the boyfriend or?
It is. I think that she had set up one really stealth New York City drive-by where she conveniently was like, we don't have time for lunch, but this is, here he is. And, you know, and this is the first, sit down experience where they actually get to spend time
together.
Where
the family meets the new guy.
Yeah.
So where does the creative process start for you in making the play? Like what was that seed?
This particular play, it took a lot of twists and turns. It started for me I was thinking a lot about fear and anxiety.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking about the things that were keeping me up at night. And
Which
that sort of,
what?
Well, that led me to this, you know, I tend to do a lot of reading then when I can't access what I'm trying to. So I started to like trying to read up about fear and anxiety. And I read accounts of like Lorca wrote this extraordinary poetry when he was in New York City after the 1929 stock market crash. And he just, you know, saw downtown Manhattan in this completely new way. And I started to become obsessed with the just thinking about the big existential fears that everybody has, our fear of poverty, our fear of ill health, our fear of losing the love of somebody, our fear of death, our fear of failure and criticism. And I mean, gradually, I took those fears and kind of built a family around them.
Uh-huh.
Literally kind of almost assigning, that was the very, right. very starting point, thinking about, you know, a character who really would be struggling with this fear of criticism or failure, a character who's struggling with ill health, a character who's struggling with, you know, the older sister in the play, just out of an 8-year relationship.
Right.
Losing the love of someone.
Right, right.
So I sort of built it almost murder mystery style.
And then
I
the one of, with probably some sort of PTSD around, you know, 9/11, which is something completely added. Sure. Anyway, it's one of those fears where it's sort of like, when's that going to happen?
Sure. And post-financial crisis. I mean, money anxiety is dripping
right.
all over the play.
Right.
I don't think there's a sense, like, I think every other sentence has some hint of, you know, even if the mother's just talking about the price of a candle and it all seems casual. I think the fear of poverty is really hovering over the play. And then I just thought, if I'm obsessing so much about fear, what if I could find a way to tell the story via a story that's actually a little scary? And that's when I started to think about the psychological thriller genre and the horror genre. And I think what ended up happening is the play is now a genre collision. It's both drawing on the traditional family play and it's completely smashed into this other genre that I love,
which is
the horror genre. I mean, literally at the end, they're all quiet nods, but I mean, you know, Reed Birney is literally going up a dark staircase with a lantern, and it's sort of the weird homage to the moment of like a Wes Craven movie where the beautiful girl is going up the stairs, and you're like, don't answer the phone, you know, just
and also,
so it's not literally that moment, but when I think of how the play works, I sort of see those moments. Again, this isn't something that I think
and
anyone else is thinking about.
Right, but you know where you were coming from.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to talk about dread in a play that conjures it.
Sure.
The kind of dread that it's trying to explore.
And I think that what's interesting is that the world you created, specifically in infusing financial fear throughout all of it, it's an interesting thing in that, you know, the class of people that go to theater casually.
Yeah.
You know, like if a character in the play that you wrote were to go see Phantom, it would be a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, like
huge deal.
Right. So there's something about the sort of like maybe not complete lack of familiarity, but lack of lifestyle of many of the audience that is going to be entering this. And so like whether or not they completely identify with that particular fear, because they probably have people working for them, not unlike the people in your play,
right.
that all the other sort of existential anxieties that all of us have,
yeah.
you know, are present, and it becomes a full organism, you know, dealing with that dread.
Yeah.
So it's completely, you know, relatable. And I like that something like your show would force, you know, somebody who lives on the Upper East Side to sort of like, you know, humanize themselves in a way. You know, and realize that no matter what level of existence you're at, that this shit is happening. And I like the idea of, now that you brought up the lantern, is that, yeah, it is equally as horrifying as to not knowing, you know, what killer is at the top of the stairs when that killer is just really the next day.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, how are we going to...
Life is terrifying. I mean, that's... I think the play, I feel like it acknowledges that life is scary and terrifying and horrifying, but it's also hilarious and exhilarating and joyful. And
there's not a character in it that you don't empathize with and relate to. And, you know, even, you know, at whatever their transgressions are, you know, whether they be emotional or actual, where you're like, yeah, that's happened.
Well, that's great. No, that makes me very happy, because I do think at the end of the day, I feel like people are so resilient. And I think people are astonishing in how funny they are in the midst of these anxieties, and how resilient. And so it's certainly not meant to be a let's look at the horrors of this group of people and all like wallow in sadness. It's kind of like, and part of me thinks it's like stepping back and saying, look at how amazing people are. Like, look at what we do, even in these, you know,
right.
Look at how we cling to each other and look at the ways we cope and get through
And everybody has these things. You're not, you know, like none of this stuff is, you know, no one killed somebody.
Nobody killed somebody. And even the, you know, even the illness in the play is, yeah, it's like, manageable. You know, she's, yeah, it's not stage four stomach cancer. Right. It's
something, these are things that, you know, in some form or another, everybody deals with and, you know, and life gives you. It's part of life. There's no avoiding any of it.
I think so. And maybe you haven't encountered all of these fears just yet, but I do think by the time, you know, we all hit the grave, it's like people...
I think that is the whole trick of it is that, you know, the language is so organic and it's not elevated in terms of like what theater, you know, sometimes is to the point where it's alienating. It actually goes the other way.
Yeah.
And then it brings people in through the basement. You know, as opposed to sort of like, wow, look at the lights. What's happening? You know, now in the process of creating this, how much do you, you know, how do you workshop something when it's not complete? And how do you start to trim these things to where they're, you know, minimal and exactly what you want? I don't know that experience as a writer, but I imagine you get a draft and do you work scenes? Do you have people read it out loud? Do you?
Yeah, it depends. This play, it took me a while to figure out, so I sort of kept it close to home, and I tend to write a lot of drafts before I show it to anyone. And then when I get a draft that I think, where I think I know what the thing is, and I'm ready for other people to start offering their thoughts, the first step for me is just actors, just sit around a table with actors. They're the best, that's the best editing comes from hearing good actors read your work.
Seeing how they sound in a mouth.
Yeah, I think for me, the just hearing it out loud, your next draft is then, I mean, that's the biggest round of changes, because you can learn so much from listening to people start to try and make sense of your work.
And when you say that you're most personal, like as we're having this conversation, you know, we're not crying, we're okay. So if you're
not crying.
If it's most
I did
personal.
Cry when I saw the view from the bathtub, though.
You want this? You want to live here?
I want to live here.
But when you say that that you're most personal on you know, through the work, you know, what in that play, you know, out of all of it, did you feel that you were able to find some catharsis personally, you know, emotionally?
I feel like the big secret is when you write a family play, everybody wants to know, is that your sister? Is that literally your mother? Is that literally your father? Did this literally happen? And for me, you can be so much more truthful when you hide behind a shield of fiction, and you can also split your personality. I think people underestimate how many of the characters are often the writer.
Right.
And I've talked to other, you know, friends and colleagues who've said the same thing, where it's like the big secret is actually that there's a lot of me in a lot of these characters.
Sure.
Instead of the very neat answer, which is like, that's my grandmother, that's my...
No, right. You know. Yeah, obviously, right. And also with these characters, if you can find a delicate and organic way to do it, they can engage and confess and admit and struggle in a way that, you know, goes unspoken.
Totally.
In most families.
Like, you know, you were talking about the tiers of relationships in the play, and I think that was completely subconscious. When I stood back, I first saw the play in a production in Chicago where it had its world premiere. I kind of, for the first time in a preview, I was like, I think I wrote a play about me trying to make sense of relationships, because you have the couple who's been together for 40 years trying to keep it together. You have the young couple who's just made the leap to move in together.
Right.
And you have Amy in the middle who's just trying to figure out if she made a huge error and where she's going after a breakup from a long-term relationship. So you're seeing the start of something, the end of something, and the consequences of maybe what it means to love someone for 40 years and how scary that can be.
But I did think it was hilarious, and I did think it was emotionally, you know, compelling and moving and completely engaging. And like, but that is a weird line that I don't know has always existed. This line in theater and on television where all of a sudden, you know, there was these two things. Is it a drama or is it a comedy?
Right.
For years, it was
like... Where did that come from?
I don't know. I think it came from television.
Yeah.
You know, that was a way of marketing things. It's like, oh, I get it. You know, they needed to be pitched and packaged in a line.
Yeah.
But now almost everything, you know, is able to contain...
Contain both, yeah.
Yeah, which is more like life.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to see even in TV that, because there are the categories in a lot of these award shows and stuff where it's like best drama and right. comedy. And yeah. I do think it's interesting that theater doesn't separate those two.
Yeah, it's great. That's where the honesty of theater comes in. And it's also like, and I'm just excited for you. I'm excited for, you know, for everybody. Because like, I'm new to this. And I, you know, the more I talk to theater people, it's like, you know, there's a whole history to this thing.
Sure.
New York theater.
Yeah.
It's always been, you know, relevant to the people that are involved in it. And on a business level, there may have been dark times where they're like, how the fuck are we going to get people to come? Right. But, you know, like, not unlike, you know, like you were saying before about, you know, social media and the lack of intimacy and also the lack of expression and the inability of people to talk, even on the phone now.
Yeah.
That there is a craving for the intensity of connection.
Yeah.
And I think that...
And the communal experience of sitting down next to other people, watching live,
right.
you know, people.
Right.
You know,
and seeing them spit.
Yeah, there's no replacing it.
Well, it was great. And congratulations on your Tony nomination.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
And the Pulitzer nomination must have been exciting.
Super exciting. And I actually know, you know, Brandon, who's another finalist, and Lynn, who won this year, are both friends. So it was kind of an amazing year.
So the community actually functions as a community.
There really is a theater community. Yeah. I'm starting to feel it more and more the more I'm a part of it.
Yeah.
But that's actually not a myth.
And moving to Broadway, I mean, how is that decided? I mean, I know Scott's your producer, but like, what is the business side of that?
The business side of it is that Scott Rudin saw a matinee right before we opened, about a week before we opened, and I was told a day or two later that he was interested in moving the show as is to Broadway, and it still feels surreal. I mean, if I'm being honest, it still feels like anytime I'm at the theater, I can't believe the show is actually across from Phantom of the Opera on 44th Street. And that's a product of Scott actually caring about the American theater. And because it's slightly unprecedented that a show without celebrities, a playwright who's not a celebrity, and a title that isn't, you know, a known title of a play, would have a commercial production on Broadway. So I'm kicking myself.
Yeah, it's pretty fresh, right?
Yeah. I don't think this is going to, I mean, I honestly feel like this is going to once in a lifetime kind of a thing.
Okay, fine.
I'm not saying it's all downhill from there. I'm just saying that, you know, writers of my generation, we don't see Broadway as the end game.
Right.
Because it's actually, in some ways, it's such a fantasy, especially if you want control.
To feel that it has specific requirements.
It might come with specific requirements, maybe ditching the actor you really want for a TV star, or just the sheer, sometimes the TV star is the right actor for your play, and you would love to get that film star who loves to do theater. But, you know, you end up might have to wait around for like 2 years for their schedule to clear up. And so I feel like my generation, we do like creating theater off Broadway and living there because
it's reasonable.
It's reasonable. And, you know, you have control of your comedy, and it's like it's you can get to the finish line knowing that it's what you wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And I feel like Broadway, that feels like a more of a fantasy that you get to make the thing on your own terms, and then someone will actually believe in it enough
and you've
to
got
move
that.
It.
Right.
And in this case, Scott Rudin was like the fairy. Godfather.
Yeah. And why don't we give some love to the cast? Who played the parents?
So the parents are played by the incredible Jane Howdy Shell and Reed Birney. Cassie Beck plays the older sister. Sarah Steele, who a lot of people know from The Good Wife, is the younger daughter. Her boyfriend is Aryan Moyed. And Lauren Klein is astonishing as the demented grandmother.
Ah, amazing. Real, like, you know, just...
You actually don't even know that she's... I mean, people touch her after the show. To make sure she's okay. And, you know, she said it's both... What's hard about doing that, which I can only imagine how hard it is sort of made up by the fact that, you know, after the show, she says she can... It's like being reborn, because she goes to that place of not being able to connect
and
being so shut down. And then she takes a curtain call and she can talk, she can move around, she can exercise,
that's
she can call people she loves.
Oh my God.
So that must be a trip for her. Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Hey, good to be here.
Oh my God, that was great.
Can I could probably write a play, right? That, you know, sometimes I used to think that more whenever I talk to people. I'm like, why can't I do that? Well, it's not what you chose to do with your life. Sure, you could write one, but I mean, yeah, kind of, you know, handle your expectations. Maybe I'll play some guitar. How would that be? I think I got a lick. I'm going to put my earplugs in, though, because I have to put my earplugs in to get the right tone without losing my hearing. Boomer lives. Boomer lives. Boomer lives.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.